Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. As we continue to make sense of a mass shooting killing 9 people at a San Jose rail yard, a timely survey shows where Californians stand on the issue of current gun laws. The Public Policy Institute of California joins us with those findings. Also, mental health is front of mind in the sports world as tennis superstar Naomi Osaka made headlines announcing she's withdrawing from the French Open. Osaka taking to social media to describe bouts of depression and anxiety playing a big role in her decision to take a break for self-care. We'll speak with Olympic gold medalist Kimberly Graham Miller and Jeff Float about mental health and athletes. Later in the hour, a Woodland Robotics team joins us with their invention that landed them in the semifinals of an international competition. But first, a coalition of bipartisan state lawmakers is calling on the Attorney General to step in and investigate a PG&E fire victim trust meant to compensate survivors of the Camp Fire, the deadliest and most destructive wildfire in California history, killed 85 people in the immediate aftermath, displacing tens of thousands of others. PG&E admitted to causing the wildfire due to neglecting aging utility equipment while prioritizing profits for shareholders. The utility giant also pled guilty to killing 84 of the victims. But more than 2 years later, what began as a $13.5 billion trust has so far gone largely to overhead costs. According to an investigation by KQED, the overwhelming majority of more than 60,000 survivors have yet to see a dime. KQED co-host and correspondent of the California Report, Lily Jamali, walks us through her investigation into the Fire Victims Trust. Welcome to Insight, Lily.
Thanks for having me on, Vicky.
You know, before we go just through all the details of your investigation, I think it's just important. What sparked your interest in investigating the Fire Victims Trust?
Well, I, like a lot of journalists, including those at CAP Radio, covered the campfire itself. And, you know, that's one of those stories where you go there and it never really leaves you. You meet so many people that are in really dire straits and are at that time, were just kind of starting to process what lay ahead of them. And here we are 2.5 years later, and most of them are waiting for money from this fire victim trust that was established in the PG&E bankruptcy as part of a settlement. And I should note that the settlement between PG&E and these fire survivors covers fires between 2015 and 2018, the Camp Fire. So you have 3 years of significant fires included, and some people have been waiting for 6 years. So my interest was sparked by, I think, you know, having covered the fire and also my background as a financial reporter, you know, there's a lot of data that's posted to the court docket. And so it's been fascinating, but also illuminating to see what's in there. And this particular investigation started by looking at this annual report that the Fire Victim Trust posted at the end of April. Thought we were going to be, you know, doing a very ho-hum story about where this money was going and kind of move on. But we found a lot more than we bargained for.
Mm. Well, what did your reporting actually find when it comes to the finances of the Fire Victims Trust?
Well, for one thing, you know, the Fire Victim Trust reported that they had spent about $38 million in the first year. They started their reporting in the middle of 2020, so from July 1st to December. But we knew, because we had covered the trial, that they had been established and had been taking in fees way back to January of last year. So we were able to uncover an additional $12.7 million that was not reported in its annual report in terms of overhead fees and expenses. And I think that was, you know, the primary thing that we found also was that there was just a lot of, you know, sort of vague answers about where the money actually was going, you know. And if you look back at some of their financial reports from last year, when they were under much more direct supervision of the bankruptcy court, they're very detailed. You know, you see exactly where all the money is going, exactly how many hours, for example, the claims administrator was charging. She charges $1,250 an hour. And so it was really specific about, you know, how many hours she had worked, what, you know, various expenses were, and exactly what the task at hand was. What was her responsibility? Same thing with, you know, various claims processors that they had hired. If you look at the annual report from this year for 2020, the one that they posted most recently, it's really broad. You just see categories. And so we had to really kind of marry that information with different sources, whether it was court filings, transcripts from court hearings last year, and even correspondence with fire victims between the trust and fire victims themselves.
I mean, you found that, like, just during the first year of operation, the trust spent nearly 90% of his funds on overhead. What is the response of the fire victims trust to why their expenses are so high and there's just a slim margin, 0.1% of the billions of dollars promised actually going to survivors?
Yeah, so 90% of what they spent last year did go to overhead, and then $7 million, the remainder, went to fire victims. And I think, you know, the main argument is that there's going to be startup costs involved. It takes a while to get a big process like this up and running. And I think that there is truth to that argument. You have 70,000 people involved, and all of them have, you know, different claims, a different profile of whether, you know, it was a home or a business, or in some cases, even a loved one. And so someone has to go through all of those claims and, you know, collate all the documents and look through them and make a determination. So that does take time. I think, you know, when we started really scrutinizing their expenses, to be honest with you, the experts that we were talking to weren't upset about $1,250 an hour and $150,000 a month going to the trustee. Crazy as that might sound, you know, we hear a lot, well, that's what people in this position charge. But the question really became, but what is the result? So if you're putting out $7 million in, you know, that first year to fire victims, and you're spending a whole lot more on overhead, that's a concern. I will also say that in this calendar year, in 2021, we have seen an uptick in money going out the door to fire victims. So at this point, actually, according to numbers that I just saw this morning, they have now spent $285 million on compensation for fire victims. But when you look at the actual number of people having their claims processed and starting to get paid, still, the vast majority have not had that happen yet.
I would imagine, despite the justification for the overhead costs, I mean, I covered the campfire as well, and I followed survivors for more than a year, that must be a hard pill to swallow when you're still, life doesn't stop and the financial challenges of your life don't stop. You talked to a retired U.S. Foreign Service officer, Bill Cook. He has been displaced like many other campfire survivors, living in Yolo County in Davis with his family. When you're talking to other survivors, what are they telling you with the reasoning and the justification for the overhead costs of this trust?
I think the unifying theme is that so many people are stuck in limbo right now. I do think that they understand to some extent that this process will take time, but, you know, they needed this money yesterday. They needed it last year. There are so many looming questions about what their future is going to look like, where they're going to send their kids to high school next year. What will their house that they want to rebuild ultimately look like, and how much can they really afford at a time, especially when in Paradise, as you know, Vicky, rebuilding costs have skyrocketed because there's so much demand for contractors and for building materials. So let's say you bought your house in the mid 70s, which a lot of people did buy their homes decades ago. Your house to rebuild what you had before, it's going to be a lot more than what you paid back then. I spoke with, actually, we visited a rally in Paradise that was organized in response to our investigation. And I got to meet a lot of people who I've spent hours on the phone with in person for the first time. One of them is a woman named Sasha Poe, who, I mean, I just mentioned she's the person who's asking herself this question: where am I going to send my daughter to high school next year? We're stuck in a rental, you know, kind of eating into our savings instead of paying towards a mortgage, which is what we had before. I'd love to play a soundbite from her, because she talked to me at that rally about why it matters to her that there is more transparency about where all these millions of dollars are going?
It matters because it's a trust that's set up for fire victims, yet so many months and years down the line, fire victims haven't seen much. Everybody is frustrated. The transparency is important.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. And okay, sorry, go ahead, Vicky.
Continue. I mean, especially since when we know with the Camp Fire, which is not only Paradise, but the communities of Magalia, Concow, and Polga, that the company actually pled guilty to involuntary manslaughter. And then more than 2 years later, they still feel that they're not getting the transparency that they deserve.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, again, we come back to this notion of, if you're going to spend a lot of money, please, you know, show us your work and show us the line by line information about where all the money is going. Name names, name firms, please. That's what we're hearing from fire victims. And that's also what we're hearing from this bipartisan group of almost a dozen state lawmakers who went to the attorney general just a couple of days ago and said, look, you know, we're seeing how, you know, we're getting these calls to our offices from our constituents, and they're saying they still haven't gotten their money. They still haven't gotten this compensation. What is the holdup? So they're asking for a review of the Fire Victim Trust's spending. They're asking for a review of its administration. And again, you know, it comes back to more transparency. What I will say is, since our story was published, we are seeing some signs of just like a general shift in thinking. A lot of this information was held very closely, but now we are seeing all the claims data, for example, being posted to the Fire Victim Trust website every 2 weeks. So instead of, you know, a random journalist having to ask a PR person for that information, it is there posted at a, you know, regular time and place for everyone to see. And I think that that's an important development. I wanted to mention another person who I spoke with at that rally, Terry Lindsay, who is living, and I'm just in terms of painting the picture of the situation that so many people are in right now, she's still living in a trailer with her family. I mean, this is a family of five and a, you know, bunch of animals as well that they were able to rescue from the campfire. They're living in this immobile home park that overlooks an arm of Lake Oroville. And she also spoke to me about, you know, what she's gone through and what her daughter, who is, I think she was 7 years old when the fire happened, you know, just how much of an emotional impact this has had on her.
And every time she sees smoke, she cries. She can't heal until we can go home in the trust. Until that report came out, I did not realize how well they're being paid. I mean, we're all squished in a tiny house.
Yeah, that was Terry Lindsay, and she was at this rally with her daughter Erica. And her daughter Erica was actually crying next to her as she was speaking in front of all of these people. And, you know, I think one of the bits of feedback that I have gotten to our investigation is, you know, you're basically making people really upset right now. And what was so heartening about talking to Terry and Erica after that rally was Erica told me she was actually really happy. For the first time, she was able to sort of confront what had happened in a different way and sort of see sort of something more hopeful, that there is, you know, this hope that there's a potential for more help on the way. Mm-hmm. And I think also this has kind of created an entry point for parents and kids that have gone through this, now that it's back in the news, to talk about it, to talk about what happened.
You were talking about the legal help. I mean, I think for some people, even though it was justified by some experts that you talked to, but they're jaw-dropping numbers. Yeah. You know, the trustee, $1,500 an hour, the claims administrator, $1,250 an hour. What has actually come out of all that help they're providing? That's a lot of money.
Yeah, I think, yes, unequivocally, it is a lot of money. What we can say is that we're seeing a pickup in the pace of payments to fire victims, and that is heartening to see. So, you know, at the end of last year, $7 million had gone out to people. Today, as we sit and talk, Vicky, we can say that $286 million has gone out. What's really concerning is, you know, okay, let's say that the pace of payments, you know, really picks up over the next couple of weeks and months. That's great. However, even if I am one of the lucky few people, there's less than 1,000 people out of 70,000 that have had their claims fully processed and started to get paid. If I am one of those people, I'm still only getting 30% of my claim value. So if I lost, let's call it $1 million right now, I'm just getting $300,000. If I lost 100,000, I'm getting $30,000. And that's really concerning because that's just not a whole lot to rebuild a house, especially again, in some of these fire ravaged communities where rebuilding costs have skyrocketed. It's just not enough. And it also creates this sort of perpetual state of limbo. The reason that that has happened is in some part because of the way this trust was structured in the first place. So during the PG&E bankruptcy, PG&E and the Lawyers for Fire Survivors agreed that they were going to fund this trust with billions of dollars in cash and a ton of PG&E stock, 500 million shares almost. So the noteworthy thing about that is they are the only group, the fire survivors, to be, you know, basically asked to take stock as their compensation. The insurance companies didn't have to do that. The municipalities like Sonoma County and Paradise and other places didn't have to do that. They got all cash on day one. So fire victims, you know, they are the only group that has been compensated partly with this stock through the trust. That stock needs to be liquidated. And when you liquidate 500 million shares, you know, you're going to tank the price of the stock. So you can't dump it all at once. It has to be tapered and done in pieces. But it just makes it really hard for people to get that money in hand quickly. And so therein, you see why we have a 30% payment on claims right now. And that's really concerning.
Not to mention investing in a company that has caused so much tragedy to surrounding communities.
That's such a good point. I mean, Vicky, right now, if you look at who holds PG&E stock, by far the biggest holder is this PG&E Fire Victim Trust. They hold 24% of the company's shares. And the next group, which is, you know, some Wall Street firm, is like 8 or 9%. It's a totally lopsided outcome. And, you know, I think a lot of times as reporters, when we see something like, oh, you know, stock is going into this compensation pool, we might think, well, that's probably normal, but this is absolutely not normal. There are very few precedents for this in the history of bankruptcy. We were reporting on this last year. And most importantly, fire victims themselves were calling this out last year. They were writing letters to Judge Dennis Montali in February and March of last year, raising the red flag about this and saying, we don't want to have any of our compensation tethered to how this company performs. The idea of giving compensation in the form of stock in the company that hurt people is really concerning. And we're actually seeing it being raised again in a bankruptcy right now involving opioid victims, the Purdue Pharma bankruptcy. So this playbook that was developed in this case, it may be grafted onto other bankruptcies involving these, you know, large groups of corporate victims.
Lily Jamali is KQED co-host and correspondent for the California Report about her investigation into the PG&E Fire Victims Trust. Thank you so much for following this, Lily.
Thanks, Vicky.
Up next, a new survey asks where Californians stand on current gun laws. Plus, we'll hear from two former Olympic gold medalists about mental health after tennis superstar Naomi Osaka announced she is withdrawing from the French Open. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. 1 week ago today, news broke that there was a mass shooting at a rail yard in San Jose. A man shot and killed 9 of his co-workers before taking his own life. A recent San Francisco Chronicle article cited data from the FBI, and they found that California had more active shooter incidents than all 50 states over the past 20 years. This despite California having some of the strictest gun laws in the country. Another shooting occurred yesterday at a fire station in Los Angeles County, where an off-duty firefighter shot 2 people, killing 1, before turning the gun on himself, according to the Los Angeles Times. The Public Policy Institute of California actually conducted a survey just before the most recent mass shooting in San Jose about where Californians stand on current gun laws. Survey analyst with the Public Policy Institute of California, Rachel Lawler, joins us now with the findings. Welcome to Insight.
Thanks so much for having me, Vicky, and also for your interest in PPIC's work on this topic.
Well, yeah, and thank you for joining us. I mean, you last asked this question back in September of 2019. What prompted you to revisit this survey more than 2 years later?
Absolutely. So in our Californians and Their Government series of surveys, we ask about a whole variety of topics that affect public policy. And so we try to get a good mix in with each survey. And asking about guns was something that, as you just mentioned, we hadn't asked about in a little while. So we thought it would be a good time to revisit that. And it, unfortunately, it just so happens that this happened right before the latest mass shooting in San Jose. So we typically try to cover topics once or twice a year. So that's kind of how we got to covering guns this time around.
What questions did you actually ask for this survey, and what were the findings?
Sure. So we asked 2 questions this time around. The first question that we asked was, how concerned are about the threat of a mass shooting in the area where you live? And as a reminder, this was in the field, the survey was in the field from May 9th through 18th. So it was before this latest shooting, which obviously may have impacted people's opinions and views on the topic. So just to keep that in mind. But we found that just prior to last week's shooting, half of Californians are very concerned, are concerned about a mass shooting in their area, with 1/4 saying that they are very concerned and another 1/4 saying that they're somewhat concerned about it. We also have an additional 1 in 4 who say they're not very concerned, and then 22% who say they're not concerned at all about it.
And when going back to your survey conducted in September of 2019, that was actually after the Gilroy Garlic Festival mass shooting. Are the numbers different when you compare them from 2019 survey to this most recent survey?
Yeah, so they are a little bit different. At that time, the share who were concerned about it was a little bit higher. We found that 2/3 of adults in California were concerned about a mass shooting. 4 in 10 were very concerned, and 3 in 10 were somewhat concerned. So as you mentioned, that was in, I believe, the month following the Gilroy shooting. So I would anticipate that if our most recent survey had been after last week's events, that we probably would have seen a similar increase like we saw in 2019.
Yeah, as we just mentioned in the beginning of this, California has some of the strictest gun laws in the country. And when looking at your survey, you also go to Texas. The state legislature is actually considering loosening gun laws if it's signed by Governor Greg Abbott. Can you talk to us about that?
Sure. So in the post that you're talking about, I do mention the new Texas legislation that I believe it would allow open carry of firearms without a permit or training. So we asked a question. It wasn't exactly asking about the same thing. It was asking about gun sales in California, but we wanted to kind of get an idea where Californians stand on gun regulations in the state. So we asked a question whether the law covering the sale of guns should be made more strict, less strict, or kept as they are now. And we found that 63%, so a very solid majority of Californians, think that they should be stricter. 2 in 10 think that they should be kept as they are currently, and just 16% think that they should be made less strict.
How does diversity play into the results of your survey?
Sure. So obviously, you know, there's great partisan differences on both of these questions that we asked. On the first question, when it comes to a mass shooting, we do find that majorities of Latinos, Asian Americans, and African Americans are concerned about shootings in their area. And 43% of whites say that they are concerned. And we also find that Latinos and African Americans are the most likely to say that they are very concerned about a mass shooting. And then when it comes to laws covering the sale of guns, we actually find broad agreement, which is not something we see super often. We, across all of the regions in the state and across the demographic groups that we survey, we find that majorities are in favor of stricter gun laws.
Rachel Lawler is a survey analyst with the Public Policy Institute of California, or PPIC. Thank you for joining us today with your survey and your findings.
Thanks so much, Vicki.
Well, you're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. Naomi Osaka, a superstar in the world of tennis and the highest paid female athlete in the world, pulled out of the French Open, citing mental health struggles, including long bouts of depression and social anxiety. Osaka's announcement at the peak of her career is sparking a larger conversation about mental health from the world's top athletes, past and present. With the Olympics coming up next month, we're joined by two gold medalists to help us better understand the mental health toll on athletes. Kimberly Graham Miller, a former Olympic sprinter, 1996 gold medalist, and now a Sac State coach. Also, Jeff Float is a former Olympic swimmer and 1984 gold medalist. Welcome both to Insight.
Thank you, Vicki, for having me.
Thank you for the invitation.
Well, Kimberly, I'm going to start with you. How are you feeling about Naomi's announcement?
I have to say, I think it was a very courageous move. I think athletes who, you know, are very good at their sport, it's very hard to come out and say that you're dealing with something in the inside. So I thought it was a very courageous move by her.
You know, Jeff, the fact that Naomi Osaka is disclosing this at the peak of her career, as opposed to in hindsight and reflecting on her career, does that stand out to you?
Reflecting on her career or where she is today as a hero within her own country of Japan and with the Olympic Games around the corner, I think she was very brave to do what she's doing. As a 23-year-old, those expectations are tremendous, and the pressure from the press and everybody else in her sphere is extremely intense at this time, especially with what's going on in Japan with the COVID crisis and the pandemic, and the fact there's only 2 or 3% of that country that's been vaccinated and in lockdown. There's a lot on her mind. So I think she's doing absolutely the right thing for herself.
You also mentioned that what you're seeing is just the tip of the iceberg. Can you explain more about that? Elaborate on it.
Well, what people see when they come into the arena to compete, they're seeing the tip of the iceberg. They don't see everything that's gone on for, you know, the previous 20 years or 15 years or how long she's been competing relative to the training and the discipline and the heartbreak and the, you know, the press and the demand of that being in that environment. So the tip of the iceberg is that there's a lot more underneath than to meet the eye when it comes to the physical and mental well-being that it takes to get there.
When hearing about Naomi Osaka and you go back to, you know, your own athleticism over the years and over the decades, you also, are there moments when you kind of go back to the burden and the weight of all of it and how you sifted through that from a mental health standpoint?
In my situation with the 1980 boycott was very similar in terms of having to cope with in 1980, if you recall, we had the Miracle on Ice, where everybody was, you know, had rampant national, you know, feelings of greatness from what happened there to not going to the Olympics in a matter of two months. And so in my case, I had, well, you know, went into a depression, it was very difficult, but I was very fortunate to have three more years of collegiate eligibility, and the fact that the Olympics were going to be in LA, you know, 3 years, four years later, that provided, you know, something to look forward to, where a lot of these athletes, this is one and done, and this is it. So it's really, I feel for today's athletes because of the uncertainty. Even right now, with the Olympic swimming trials around the corner, and we don't know if they're even going to come off. So it's very testy, and I can see where there's, you know, the necessity for the, you know, mental health approaching it. Just like I've got an injury to my foot. Well, I need to take care of that. I need to take care of my mind, body, and spirit connection. That is so important for most of these athletes that have a purpose-driven life.
Kimberly, you're also a Sac State coach. How do you reflect on the pressures that you shouldered in the Olympics and as an athlete, and then and now helping future athletes kind of cope with the same type of pressure?
I think it's important to have a good support staff and to use your resources. There are several different resources that you can use when you're dealing with some anxiety or, you know, feeling the pressure of being good. For me, I think it was important to, you know, the people that I was surrounded by kind of helped me, you know, deal with the pressure. There are sports psychologists, as far as my athletes, that we refer them to the resources that we have. They can go sit and talk with someone to have to deal, and, you know, they help them deal with, you know, anxiety or how to handle success or failure. I think that's really important.
You know, and this comes as, you know, initially many tennis players, they had been reluctant to embrace Osaka's choice of avoiding reporters at the French Open. Did you experience, or was there kind of a culture or a stigma or a taboo when it came to mental health and disclosing challenges with the pressure and being put on a pedestal and perfectionism as an athlete?
Oh, most definitely. I think, like I said earlier, I think that's why I feel like she's so courageous, because, you know, everyone sees what's on the outside. They don't see what's in the inside. And as a professional athlete, you don't want to disclose your weaknesses and what you're dealing with. So, it's a lot. I admire her for, you know, acknowledging that she was dealing with something, because, you know, not everyone does that. They just kind of deal with themselves. So I think, you know, I admire that she came out and said, I just can't do it, you know. So I thought it was very, you know, courageous of her again.
Yeah. And clearly it's clear that you can relate to her as well, going back to that time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, most definitely. Yeah. It's a lot of pressure.
Yeah. Jeff, I think it's important to kind of separate the two, how mental fitness compares with physical fitness. You touched upon that, and I think it's important to really elaborate between the two.
Well, there is no difference. I think there's been a paradigm shift toward mental health being an acceptable, necessary part of the overall health approach. And today, compared to when I was training, it was kind of like it wasn't even on the radar. Well, now, especially with the, you know, COVID in the last year, you know, you're seeing a lot of that mental health, not just with athletes, but, you know, just society in general, and dealing with the lockdowns and no school and those kinds of things that have happened that have a dramatic effect on our mental health. And so, you know, I think we're being more accepting that it's okay to say, hey, you know, I'm not feeling good about this, or, you know, I need to talk to somebody about, you know, why I'm feeling the way I am, or how come I'm, you know, what can I do to get out of my depression, or, you know, it's tough with the press because they put you up on a pedestal, and at the same time, you know, they're looking for the headline, and it may, you know, like in the situation with Naomi, you've got people coming across criticizing her as much as people supporting her. So it just seems to be a paradigm shift toward the mental health being okay. Just like I broke my foot, and you know, right now I'm just need a little attention to my mental faculties to keep me on the right track.
And after the amount of drive, motivation that goes into for an athlete, the last thing they want to do is have a microphone in their face after losing, right?
Well, that's just it. How many, you know, the old cliche, you know, after you finish fourth or, you know, or whatever, and you know, how does it feel to finish fourth? Well, that's the last thing we want to think about when we've come out, you know. And I was interviewed after my race, but I had a lot of time to decompress, you know, after I finished in fourth. To be able to have an interview with somebody as opposed to being right after the event, you know. So it just, you know, people don't realize that to reach that level, you reach a peak, and it takes, you know, time to do that, and it's well decompress after an event. But you know, for me in 1984, it took me so long just to come down from such a high in addition to what now. And so that's part of the mental health that you know, is important to those athletes. You know, you're putting all your eggs in one basket, then you're going to have some problems. But if you diversify your thinking and your life and not putting everything, you know, into one thing totally, it allowed for diversification of yourself to be able to, you know, get ahead, so to speak, with the challenges.
Kimberly, you know, when talking about that peak, how did you kind of cope after becoming an Olympic gold medalist and then obviously going on to other chapters of your life?
Wow, good question. I have to go back to just having a plan in place, you know, all along. I knew I was going to be a coach because I was kind of volunteering, coaching while I was training as an athlete. So I kind of knew my next steps or my next chapter after I was finished with the, you know, running. After the Olympic Games, I continued to run a few more years. So, I just went on and started training again, you know, after I finished the Olympic Games.
Do you think that in the age of social media, you know, it's just the challenges and the pressure and the mental health pressure is just exacerbated?
No, yes, question. Most definitely. The pressure is unreal, and it's hard for someone to, you know what it feels like unless you're actually in the midst of it.
Jeff, you chimed in too. You agreed.
Yeah, I echoing Kimberly's situation, you know, after the 84s, I didn't have anything to do with swimming for about 10 years, and then I kind of found my way to coaching. And I can say to Kimberly, you know, she had a passion for running, and now she's kind of giving back to sharing her experience with the next generation, and I've been doing that for 25 years, and it's just it's a great, you know, avenue to you know, focus that all that you did as an athlete now as a coach. So good job, Kimberly.
Thank you.
Well, on that note, Olympic gold medalists Kimberly Graham Miller and Jeff Flo, thank you both for joining us this morning and sharing your experiences.
You're
Thank
welcome.
You.
Well, still ahead, a Woodland robotics team has advanced to the semifinals of an international competition. The students will join us with their innovative invention. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Out of a field of nearly 1,000, a Woodland robotics team is now in the semifinals of an international competition. The team, 5458 Digital Minds, is made up of high schoolers from Woodland and Pioneer High in Yolo County. The International Robotics Competition is put on by FIRST. That's an acronym which stands for Inspiration and Recognition of Science and Technology. This accomplishment is even sweeter after the team's robot was derailed last year due to COVID-19 shutting down competitions. Joining us now to walk through their latest robot is 5458 Digital Minds mentor, Christina Rolfe, and Pioneer and Woodland High School students Ayantu Tamen, Matthew Rowe, and Mason Warner. Thank you for joining us and congratulations.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
All right, Christina, I'm going to start off with you. You're their mentor. Can you just explain what the FIRST robotics competition exactly is?
Yeah, so the FIRST robotics competition is a international competition specifically for high school students. So the FIRST program as a whole is a nonprofit organization that has four levels of competition. The first is FIRST Lego League Junior, which is for elementary school students. There's FIRST Lego League that goes for mostly middle school students. FIRST Tech Challenge, which is available for both middle and high school students, and our level, the FIRST Robotics Competition, which is for high school students specifically. So we're part of the high school FIRST Robotics Competition program, and on a year-to-year basis, what that usually entails is building a robot that's about 120 pounds and competing with other teams throughout the world at competition with that robot. So the robot is designed to do a specific challenge that they release on a yearly basis, and that challenge changes from year to year.
What impressed you most about your mentees?
Yeah, so I'm actually a graduate student at UC Davis, and my background is in biomedical engineering. So as my job, I actually teach the senior design program. And a lot of what we teach in senior design is very similar to what we did in the innovation challenge. And I think what I was most impressed about is that these students who are high schoolers were able to create a successful product that, you know, and follow an engineering design process that we don't expect students to actually master until they're seniors in college. So that was the most impressive thing to me, is that they've already achieved this success at the high school level.
Well, Ayantu, I'm going to turn to you first. Can you just talk to us about what y'all designed for your innovation that now got you into the semifinals?
Yeah, so for our innovation, we were tasked with coming up with a device that would help users' physical and or mental health through active movement. So we came up with a lot of different ideas for our device. And then we brainstormed, we voted on our final device, and we came up with a form monitoring fitness device that would monitor users' form and make sure that they wouldn't run into injuries down the road. And after doing that, we used our engineering skills that we developed throughout previous years on the robotics team, and we split up different tasks and worked on the programming, electrical, and kind of the design of our cage casing. And so that was kind of the process we went through for our device.
Well, Matthew, I watched the videos that you guys provided. Can you just explain how this device actually works?
Yeah, absolutely. So as a form monitoring fitness device, it's intended to fit around the moving joints of a body. So you could connect it around a knee, around an elbow, maybe even around a shoulder. And it uses what's called an inertial measurement unit, an IMU. That's actually where its namesake comes from, I Am Unstoppable. And what it does is it senses the data in real time of the joint's angle and the joint's acceleration. And it'll interpret this data in a computer as to what a proper exercise should be through some predetermined thresholds. So this device will feed you constantly updating values of where your joint is in space relative to the other sensor. And it will actually vibrate to alert you if you're doing something wrong with the exercise.
All right, Mason, that brings me to you. You know, last year, y'all created a robot, and obviously that didn't happen with COVID-19. But what you essentially created is a form monitoring fitness device that can be used for in-home workouts. And when you demonstrated it, it was like doing a bicep curl and making sure that people don't injure themselves or overexert themselves. How did it feel now being in the semifinals after being disappointed last year?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's really nice being in the semifinals. I think that it's a great accomplishment, and it's really where our team excels, is in the design process and really just after the devastation of COVID and not being able to use a robot, it's just really nice to be this far ahead in a competition.
And I think it's important to mention that you're the only team selected from the Greater Central Valley region. So that's a huge accomplishment, given that this is an international competition. Christina, going back to you, what's the next step? They're in the semifinals. How do we find out when the actual finals take place and if they advance?
Yeah, so the finals are taking place June 28th through 30th. It's going to be sort of a virtual showcase at that point. So we actually did find out that we are not finalists. However, for us, that does not mean that we're going to stop. So the really cool thing about the technology that we used is we are able to use that electronics, that programming, and use the device that we created to train new students so that they're able to, you know, hit the ground running when we build a robot next year. And we plan to actually continue with this device and maybe even sell it, maybe through a Kickstarter campaign or something like that. So that's all up in the air at the moment. I think we're just trying to get our feet under us a little bit from getting to the semifinals, but there's going to be a lot of possible opportunities for this device down the road, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially considering over the past year during the pandemic, a lot of people were doing at-home workouts. So it'd be nice to have a device like that that could help you kind of reduce injuries and overexertion.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, what does the future hold? I think you all want to hold a summer camp and help other students in this June and July, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's been a tradition for our team now. We couldn't do it last summer due to COVID. But Team 5458 actually hosts annual summer camps for students in the area, grades 4 through 8. We work with some VEX IQ robots, with the primary focus being developing a robot, programming a robot, and sort of iterating on the designs that these younger kids come up with. We have simple instructions and simple mechanisms, but it's all about sort of engaging the younger generation's imagination as to what they can do with robotics. It certainly sets up security for another generation of our team. But more importantly, it gets our students sort of inspired to get involved in the STEM community and think about robotics or think about what they could do, sort of following the engineering mindset.
And that is Christina Rolfe, Ayantu Tamen, Matthew Rowe, and Mason Warner. They're joining us to discuss their robotics invention that landed them in the semifinals of an international competition. Thanks for joining us and congratulations on the accomplishment. Well, that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.